welcome to the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming national agenda series, Direction Democracy, which will examine where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. I'm your host, Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. You may recall we did this podcast a year ago under the Midterm Matters banner, a reflection of the CPC's previous national agenda series focused on the midterm elections. We're proud to say that that was named Best Podcast in the Delaware Press Association's 2019 Communications Contest and earned an honorable mention in the 2019 National Federation of Press Women's Communications Contest. So we are excited to be back to do it all again. And to get us started, we are joined by one of the stalwarts of last year's podcast, the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, who teaches communication and political science, and Dr. Paul Brewer, the CPC's Research Director and Professor of both Communication and Political Science and International Relations. I thank you both for being with us on this year's first edition of the Direction Democracy podcast.
Yay, great to be here.
Yes, this is my first one of these, so I'm excited to be part of it.
So I wanted to start with, and I assume that you both will be able to speak to this at length, exactly what the Direction Democracy a National Agenda Series is going to cover. What can people expect from this National Agenda Series coming up next fall?
I think what I would really had in mind was there's been a lot of tumultuous movement in a lot of issues around guns, around abortion rights, around lots of things that are sort of challenging the Constitution. In fact, a lot of people are throwing around the term constitutional crisis. And I thought it would be a really good time to kind of look back through the lens of various different folks in journalism, in politics, and really kind of reflecting on where we're at. Is this something new? Is this a replay? Is this a blip on the radar? So kind of a really, hopefully a really interesting discussion over the course of the fall semester.
Paul, are there some things that you kind of hope to glean from this particular series?
Yeah, well, building on what Professor Hoffman said, Joe Biden recently created quite a stir when he said that the Trump administration was, what was the exact word, an anomaly, an aberration.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some people in the Democratic Party see it that way, some don't. But I think that's the big question that this next year is all about. Is that the new normal in U.S. politics? Or is this sort of a brief period where everything looked like it was going to change, but then it snapped back? Are the institutions or the norms strong? Or once you start to knock them over, do they just fall apart?
So I want to seize on what you were talking about, Lindsay, which is this, you know, constitutional crisis concept. And it's one that we seem to be experiencing right now because of this, particularly because of this tug of war between the president and Congress continuing. Some of it laid out in what we saw in the Mueller report, some of how that report's release was handled, and obviously the kind of continuing ignoring of subpoenas and things like that that just seems to be creating this, maybe even fueling more tension between these two particular branches of government. Where do you feel we are in terms of using that phrase, constitutional crisis?
I think I was reading something the other day that that was talking about constitutional crisis and the fact that really there's no real definition of what that means. There's nothing in the Constitution about what a crisis might be. Apparently, it has only appeared twice in the history of Supreme Court majority opinions and only three times referring to an American history in non-majority opinions. So it's kind of a, you know, what we would call a frame, and it's getting tossed around, and I don't know if anybody really understands exactly what it means. I think that what this calls our attention to in this moment where we're in this, you know, Twitter second by second media ultra saturated environment, is that's why I like this theme, is that I'm going to ask people to kind of slow down and reflect, look back, and what can we learn from history? What can we learn from this, you know, 240 plus year history of this unique experiment that is American democracy, and you know, kind of step away from the keywords, the frames, and really kind of analyze it a little more deeply.
Paul's going to ask you, because, I mean, you do polling, right? So when you look at something like constitutional crisis and think about, you know, maybe polling people's opinions on something like that, I mean, what do you think about how that type of thing should be broached with people to kind of get real feedback on, or does the fact that maybe there's no real definition of it it's in the eye of the beholder.
Yes, and you know, to be the bearer of bad news, if you poll the public on their knowledge of the Constitution, you won't come away with very pretty results.
That would be called non-attitude, right?
Yes. You know, ask members of the public to name a couple First Amendment rights, for example, and you're going to get a lot of blank stares. So,
to ask about the constitutional crisis, maybe a bridge too far.
it's a bridge too far, and I think people's reactions to the term, but Lindsay called it a frame, and I think that's a great term for it, which is how people feel about it is probably going to depend a lot on what the leaders on their side say. So, you know, if there are a lot of Democratic leaders in Congress saying, well, this is a constitutional crisis because, you know, the White House is resisting constitutional legislative oversight of the executive branch, then, you know, most Democrats who are paying attention are going to believe that. Whereas if, you know, the Trump administration says, no, Congress has actually a very narrow authority to ask for any kind of information from us, then, you know, Trump supporters are going to go along with what he has to say.
And I guess based on that, Lindsay, I mean, it almost feels like then constitutional crisis is inherently kind of a political thing rather than an actual, you know, academic or structural thing.
Oh my gosh. Yes, it's politics. it's absolutely just a political ploy. You know, it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about this in the context of the recent anti-abortion laws that are being passed in several states. And it's very clear the people who are involved in that are saying, we want this to be basically be a challenge to the Constitution. We are openly challenging the Constitution. And I don't know, I just kind of find it kind of fascinating where some people say, you know, this is a crisis. Some people say, you know, we need to change the Constitution. I think you're right, Paul. I don't know if people really even understand what any of that means. And I think we also have to keep in mind that at this point in the campaign, people don't know who the candidates are. They don't really care. It's only like wonks like us that are really kind of digging in deep to all the dialogue and what everybody's saying about everything. So I think that's kind of the point of the speaker series, not to get back to it, but is to provide like, okay, everybody, let's chill out. Let's ignore all the hype and talk about this and what this means.
And you mentioned the kind of looking back piece of it, and is this something new or not? And okay, I'm the history geek guy, so I was like, oh, let me look about constitutional crises in the past, and there were. I mean, I knew right off the top of my head that, you know, FDR's court packing plan was one of those ones that was considered. Then you have the nullification crisis of 1832, which had to do with tariffs and South Carolina threatening to secede before they actually seceded later for the Civil War. And then, of course, Watergate also kind of raised some of these same, you know, constitutional questions about executive power versus congressional power. And I think, Paul, you said it earlier. I mean, I guess the question in some ways that we have to ask is there something different about this particular quote-unquote constitutional crisis, or are, as you were saying, the kind of underpinnings and foundations of institutions durable enough to survive as they did in those cases, or is there something inherently different now that means maybe they're not as durable and maybe they're more fragile than they used to be? Is there something inherently different about our age that maybe was not the same then?
Technology, for sure. I think that, you know, when we go through periods of transition with technology, it absolutely changes the structure of how we operate as human beings. You know, we're always going to be testing the system. And I found a quote from T.E. Lawrence, who you might recognize as Lawrence of Arabia, who actually said, "The printing press is the greatest weapon in the armory of the modern commander," one of the most successful warriors in the Middle East history. So, really, since the printing press, every technological development since then has brought with it massive changes in not just politics, but culture and how people communicate with each other.
Yeah, something I'd add to that is polarization. So if you look back at one of the last great contests over executive branch power versus legislative branch power, it'd be Watergate.
Right.
But at that point in time, there were many more Republican and Democratic politicians who were willing to cross party lines for a lot of complicated reasons.
Sure.
And partisanship among the public maybe wasn't as hardened either. Now you look at, you know, Trump has an approval rating of 80-90% among Republicans in the public. And there are very few Republican politicians who are going to stand against him, even in a potential crisis situation like this. So, you know, you have some who kind of go through the motions of challenging him, like Mitt Romney or Ben Sasse. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at do they oppose him on votes that really matter? And you don't really see a lot of divergence there.
I do want to ask about maybe some more, maybe some different kind of attacks on democracy. And we can look no further than the Mueller report, which talked a lot, particularly in the first half of it, about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And regardless of the Trump campaign's involvement in that, that was a major attack on democracy. That seems to be largely a consensus at this point. And I guess the question I'm wondering, and we talked a little bit about the politicization of all this, has the political wrangling over the Mueller report kind of obscured that particular threat and what it could mean, you know, moving forward in 2020?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree that it's kind of muddied the waters. That this really is truly a threat. And even though we have a system that is very decentralized in terms of voting on election day, it's still possible that there can be a substantial impact in one location, in one district, in one state. So I think that it's something that as Americans, we should hold as one of the most valuable rights that we have, is the right to vote and for our vote to matter and to count. So I'm frankly a little surprised that people aren't more upset about it, because that's always been kind of part of who we are.
And to your point, I mean, the fact that a lot of, particularly like, you know, the presidential elections do come down to certain states and certain spots in certain states, that does, you know, kind of, even though you have that kind of decentralization of the voting, it still has a real impact if you're talking about, well, you just need to win a few districts, a few counties in a certain state to swing a major swing state in your direction.
Yeah, I kind of think back to what happened after 2000 when there were concerns about the electoral system, different kinds of concerns, you know, after the Florida recount. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a half-hearted push to improve how the electoral process ran. I think we're seeing a replay of that, maybe even stronger, following the 2016 election, where any conversation about how to make our electoral process more secure gets wrapped up in a partisan debate, because any conversation about that becomes perceived as a threat to the perceived legitimacy of the outcome in 2016, and gets framed as, well, if you're saying that we need to change how we do our elections, then you're questioning whether Trump was the legitimate winner in 2016 or not. So it's a partisan issue now, and that makes it very difficult to come up with the kind of full-scale compromise and effort, because we have these 50 states with, actually 50 states in D.C., with each with their own electoral system, and some of it's decentralized even more than that. Mm-hmm. So it's really a patchwork, and it's hard to make it secure without a consensus.
Yeah, if I can jump in, I found this, the Washington Post put together this really interesting interactive about, they examined, I think it was over 5,000 tweets. So this is kind of the new proxy for what the candidates are thinking about and talking about. And I found it really interesting because some candidates are really focusing on things like infrastructure social justice issues. And they had one category called voting rights. And I thought, well, you know, after 2016, there's going to be a lot of Democratic candidates who are going to be talking about voting rights. And it's pretty much a non-issue. I think Castro and Klobuchar are the only ones who register in the 20% of their tweets have to do with voting rights. So I think Paul's right. It's complicated. It's partisan. It's one of those things that's easier just shoved under the carpet.
Well, I was going to say, it is also this kind of renewed interest and movement forward on the national voting compact, where, you know, states will say, like, well, we're going to give all of our electoral votes to whoever the winner of the national popular vote is. Is that kind of, to your point, this idea of like, well, this is a really complex issue. Let's just make it simple, okay? Like, if everybody just agrees that the one who wins the popular vote should get all the electoral votes, we're fine. Is that almost like an effort to kind of like simplify it and find an answer in simplicity that may not actually be there?
Yeah, I think the Electoral Compact runs into the same issue that a constitutional amendment would. So, you know, if you do want to get the Electoral College, you have to have a constitutional amendment. The Compact is sort of trying to end run around that. Mm-hmm. But so far, they've gotten all the low-hanging fruit. And when they get to the swing states, you know, the Colorados and the Wisconsins and the Pennsylvanias and the Michigans, are they going to sign on?
Right.
That's, I think, where the whole thing falls apart.
So, speaking of 2020 and looking ahead, if one sign of a healthy democracy is willingness of people to run for office, then the Democrats are showing that our democracy is in great shape.
Oh, my goodness.
Like the Republicans in 2016, there is no shortage of candidates, including, as we mentioned earlier, Delaware's own Joe Biden. But before we get to the vice president, the former vice president, I have to ask, is there a point where there's too many candidates? How many candidates are too many candidates?
I think this is the most we've seen at this point, right?
I think it is in terms of serious candidates mm-hmm. who bring the kind of traditional credentials that we've seen from presidential candidates.
Sure.
Well, what I find interesting is they've actually just announced, NBC's announced that they're hosting the first presidential Democratic presidential debates in June, in mm-hmm. Miami, on June 26th and 27th. And, they, of course, they have to split it up into two nights.
And it's still not going to be enough room.
It's still not going to be enough room because apparently 18 candidates have qualified. They have to pass one of two thresholds, either register at least 1% support in at least three polls or collect 65,000 online donations. So you kind of wonder if we're going to be in this situation where we're having like week-long debates because there's so many candidates.
Well, you know, if you're candidate number 21, I kind of feel like you sort of have to hang your head and maybe slink away into the corner.
So 20's the cap.
Can we have it like, you know, like American Idol? They have like two nights of debates, then the public votes on who the best debaters were. They meet in the next debate and they just winnow it down.
Well, really, you're missing the essential stage, which is the tryouts where you have like the real bottom of the barrel.
Is that not the candidate's rollout and how well their rollout goes? Is that kind of considered the audition phase and yes. people judge the rollout, whether do they need to re-roll out their campaign? Speaking of rollouts, I mean, Biden has, after his rollout, appeared to land right into the front runner's position. If you're judging solely by polls and media coverage, Paul, I'll start with you on this. I mean, you know, how much does that really mean at this point?
It's not meaningless, but it's not necessarily a strong indicator. So if you look at it, you know, Biden could go on to win the nomination. You know, certainly he's not, that's not an outlandish idea for a candidate in his standing. You know, if you compare him with some candidates who flamed out pretty early, I think in Rudy Giuliani or Joe Lieberman, mm-hmm. his numbers don't look like theirs.
Right.
Because he's strong not just nationally, but he's also got leads in the early states where we don't actually have a national primary. You have to win those early states. And he looks more or less like he does nationally in this early states, unlike, say, Giuliani or Lieberman did, where their support at the national level is really sort of a mirage. But, you know, he's also not as strong a front runner as Hillary Clinton was in 2016, and sure. that turned out to be a very tight race. So, you know, you look at people in his position, Gore in 2000, yes, he went on to get the nomination. Or, on the other hand, you have Hillary Clinton in 2008, where she didn't, so this is a really could go either way situation.
Yeah, and I think just looking at some of those, the most recent polling, the person who Biden seems to have taken some favorability from is Sanders. Mm-hmm. So, like the most recent poll that I was looking out of SSRS from CNN is Biden in approval. Among Democrats or Democratic leaning independents who are registered. 39% of them favor Joe Biden compared to the second place is 15% for Bernie Sanders.
And that's pretty consistent with the other polls. You've seen when Biden did his rollout, his numbers went up pretty sharply. Mm-hmm. I think they've kind of peaked now. Mm-hmm. Don't know whether, do they drop from there? Do they level off? They seem to have plateaued at least. Whereas Sanders was the candidate who had the biggest drop. And at first glance, that might seem weird because if you look at them ideologically, they're pretty far apart, at least within the band of traditional Democratic Party ideology. But I think a lot of voters aren't necessarily thinking about it in as strict policy terms as, you know, political junkies like us might. And those are the two best-known Democratic candidates, and they're also demographically pretty similar, I think it's fair to say.
Sure.
So, you know, it makes sense in a way that he's siphoning support off from Sanders more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
The other question I think this kind of brings up, and it's one that you hear, I guess, you know, each cycle at some point is, should these campaigns be this long? You know, other places in the world, the campaigns are very truncated. And what does that say about our democracy that we kind of let it get started so early and let it run on so long? Is that something that maybe should be discussed maybe a little bit more deeply in this country?
It should be. I don't think it's going to change, much like other things are just not destined to change. And we're America. We can do it as big and as loud as we want, as long as we want. So I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that because American campaigns are unusual in an international context in terms of their length and in terms of how much money we spend on them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think there's at least a kind of argument worth considering, which is that we have lots of other things that run on really long, like seasons of Game of Thrones, or the baseball season, that you could argue have less, you know, maybe I'm being controversial, that have less impact on the day-to-day lives
maybe less
of
consequence,
people.
Yeah.
Less consequence. And, you know, this is the single most important decision that we make as a country. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's okay.
Good point. See, now, that's why we have this podcast, because you don't hear that opinion that often, I don't think. I do want to touch on another area that I think is kind of linked to this larger discussion of democracy in this country, and that is the issue of special interest influence. And perhaps how something that just happened recently here in Delaware may speak a little bit to this issue. And a fair amount has been made of the NRA's recent leadership issues. Perhaps maybe the NRA is losing a little bit of its influence. But just last week, Delaware State Senate... State Senate President Pro Tem, Democrat David McBride, who promised to vote on all gun bills this year, steered them into the executive committee, which he chairs to assure that, voted with the Senate Majority Leader, Nicole Poor, another Democrat, not to release three major gun bills from that committee to a floor vote. McBride says the bills lack support. Advocates for these bills say polling shows that people want them. The midterm results last year back that up. I'm not looking for you guys to litigate the issue of whether the bill should have gotten a vote and whether a promise was broken, but I guess I'm looking at the kind of, you know, more macro issue here of, you know, is this another indication that the NRA and other pro-gun groups still hold a major influence, and that these groups like them and on other topics and areas continue to hold that kind of influence, and maybe an influence that is not necessarily reflective of where the majority of people are on a given issue, and how big is that of an issue for our democracy going forward?
Yeah, just to start with a little side note, it's funny, you know, we tend to call them interest groups when we agree with them, and special interests when we're calling their influence into question. But this is a case certainly where if you look at not just public opinion in Delaware, I did see that poll, and it looked, mm-hmm. you know, it was obviously done by an interest group or a special
sure.
interest in favor of stricter gun laws. But the results lined up fairly well with what we see in national trends where a majority of the public, a pretty clear majority, supports things like background checks and limits on assault weapons and so forth.
High-capacity magazines.
That sort of thing. So the public as a whole tends to be pretty sympathetic to, you know, not taking away everybody's handguns, but at least a certain level of restrictions on gun ownership. But it's difficult to get it through legislatively because that's the way our system is set up, where it's easy to block things. It's difficult to get things done, even when there's a majority of the public in favor of something. So in this case, I think it's the Democratic majority in the Delaware Senate is pretty narrow. Mm-hmm. So really, you only need to lose a couple of people who are maybe in closer districts and worried about, worried about next year and worried about the influence of maybe the NRA in turning out people to vote, even though the NRA, at least at the national level, has gone through some really interesting times, would be the most charitable way to put it, with a major leadership war
sure.
and contrasting allegations of financial malfeasance and so forth. But you can say this doesn't just happen with gun laws either.
Mm-hmm.
You look at things like legalization of marijuana mm-hmm. or even getting rid of the Electoral College.
Right.
These are all issues where the public would favor something, but it's pretty easy to block that from happening.
Well, and if I can interject here, I taught a course this semester on public opinion, and we were looking back at the history of, you know, Plato, Socrates, all these folks who have opined about the role of the public. And let's face it, folks, it's only very, very recently that politicians, or at least politicians, say they care about what the public thinks.
And
philosophers said they're stupid, don't pay attention to them. And I think we're kind of like public opinion polling crazy these days. And politicians will respond to those public opinion polls if there's pressure enough for them to do anything, but oftentimes it's irrelevant. There are more powerful special interests or interests at play.
And, you know, I have to point out, so I'm a big fan of the musical Hamilton, but one thing that musical leaves out is what Alexander Hamilton thought about the public and public opinion.
Oh, there are plenty of founding fathers who did not.
Yeah, he was really down on public opinion, and he did not place a lot of faith in it. He was what we'd call an elitist these days.
No, there's no doubt about that within the founding fathers. And I guess the other thing that some people do argue, and I'm curious what you think about this, is that eventually, if something really does have that public support, it eventually seems some would argue, to happen eventually. But, you know, look, you look at Delaware with marriage equality. It kind of took step after step after step, but it kind of came around after, if you had looked at it maybe a few years prior, it seemed like there was no chance it was going to happen.
I think that's
marijuana legalization, another example.
I think that's an exception, honestly. And I don't know how much you've thought about why that issue in particular gained so much traction so quickly. Because if you look at polling over time, trends over time, and support for same-sex marriage or marriage equality, it was not that long ago that there were complete minority.
Yeah, it was in the 90s. It mm-hmm. was maybe about a quarter of the public. And public opinion on big policy issues rarely changes as rapidly and profoundly. And the striking thing about that issue was part of that was younger people being more supportive. But a lot of older people changed their mind over the course of a couple decades.
Do you think it's because of the fact that many people know someone? It's a son or a daughter or a cousin or a friend?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's difficult to pick apart. But I think it's one of those things that once the ball started rolling, there are a lot of things reinforcing. So when there's not a lot of public acceptance of LGBT people, they're unlikely to be out. But when there's more public acceptance, then they're more out.
Like
Ellen.
And then you know
that you know people.
Yeah.
And then when a few states legalize same-sex marriage and the world doesn't end, then it becomes easier. You know, start with civil unions and then marriage. And then, you know, everything stays the same. And it becomes very hard, these doomsday arguments, oh, it's going to destroy the fabric of our nation. It just doesn't happen. Right.
Well, and then media plays such an important role, too. Ellen was hugely instrumental, I think, in acceptance of gay Americans and Will and Grace. You know, these were both 80s and 90s shows that I think really impacted a large number of people because, of course, at that point, we did have cable, obviously, but people were watching shows as a nation.
Right.
I think that's, if I can go back to Game of Thrones for just a second, because I've actually never watched it. I've never watched even one episode. You haven't?
I haven't, no.
But I think the reason that our students really like it so much is because it's a communal experience. They all want to watch it live, and they want to be experiencing that together.
And then talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's so telling. You were asking about sort of what's different about our time, and it's like nobody's really engaged in the same moment at any moment. We're all just distracted by our own social media circles, our echo chambers, and I think that's damaging. I think it's damaging to patriotism, to pride in our nation. I think it's what's leading to this kind of general malaise that's not Game of Thrones is not leading to the malaise, but the disconnect that we have from each other. You know, there's a great book called Alone Together. You know, we're together, but we're not really together. We're all looking at our phones or other devices. So sorry, I went a little off track.
Yeah,
but I
think that's a very compelling point where I was talking about the increasing polarization in American politics, and some people, there's a big debate over this, have linked that to the fragmentation of media, where back in the 70s or 80s, pretty much everybody was getting their news from ABC, NBC, CBS, for better or for worse.
Right.
And now about the only things that bring together national conversation are Game of Thrones or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I have watched all of those.
Right. And honestly, even if you go into the sports realm, something like the Olympics, which used to be such a huge thing, and everyone watched it, it was a national pride thing, it pulled people, no matter what your beliefs are or anything, you all wanted to vote, you know, root for USA. And the Olympics have kind of like petered out as well. And they're almost like a sideshow now.
They weren't even on the network, right? You had to watch them like
on demand. Well, they were on the network,
but
everything's like kind of time moved, and it is not a communal thing anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing. So let's finish up this first episode with what we always do, which is a quick hot take or a hot quick take from each of you, something lighthearted, a prediction, something you feel is not getting the attention it deserves. Since Paul hasn't done this, Lindsay, I'll let you go first to show him how it's done.
Oh, great. Well, I'm stepping on his toes a little bit because I was going to talk about public opinion polling, which maybe isn't lighthearted, but having taught a public opinion class this semester, it was really enlightening to me how little people know about how polling works and how many things can go wrong. And so, for example, there was a poll that came out in the middle of the semester that right after the Mueller report, all these headlines said, Trump's approval rating drops 3%. And my students were like, wow, that's, you know, oh my gosh, did you see that news? And I said, did you look at the margin of error, which is 3.5%? So I just want to kind of remind people that that we're going to be seeing poll after poll after poll, day after day. You know, Gallup does daily tracking polls. They do polls 350 days of the year, and that's just Gallup. So we're going to be seeing from news organizations, from special interest groups, and I just want people to kind of give it a little skeptical eye. Make sure that the news article links to the poll. I know it's going to be boring, but click on that link and see what the sample size is, see what the margin of error is, and just understand that polls in and of themselves can just be news. They can make headlines, but they might really be meaningless.
So since there's been this Game of Thrones theme, I thought, even though neither Lindsay or I has actually watched it.
I think we're the only ones.
Sometimes it seems that way. But there's actually some research on the political effects of entertainment television. And I think there are even some people looking at the politics of Game of Thrones and whether that can influence viewers. And we've already talked about how in the past, entertainment shows like Will and Grace may have had an impact on what people think about LGBT rights. There's been other research looking at the impact of The West Wing on how people view the presidency, or remember that TV show 24, mm-hmm. on how people viewed torture, which was a big issue a while ago.
Or going back to Archie Bunker.
Yes. And whether everybody who watched Archie Bunker actually got the humor, or right. whether they were kind of rooting for Archie Bunker, even though the show was constructed to undercut him. So I'm not exactly sure what impact Game of Thrones might have on viewers, although I think it's interesting that apparently there are some fans who are complaining when people try to present political interpretations of Game of Thrones, saying, no, don't bring politics into Game of Thrones. Whereas my understanding is it's called Game of Thrones. How can it not be political?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Well, I want to thank you both, Dr. Paul Brewer and Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, both from the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication, for joining us on this first episode of the Direction Democracy podcast. We look forward to many more of these as the next National Agenda series gets underway. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Direction Democracy podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more information on the UD Center for Political Communication's Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu.